Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, February 4th, 2020. Kenyans react to the death of their long-term former leader.
He was quick to read the changing times. He was quick to see that the wind was so strong he could not stop it. So he quickly allowed in change, and as the saying says, don't stop change. Bring it on and then manage it. I think he did that very, very, very effectively.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Daniel Arap Moi, who served Kenya as president between 1978 and 2002, died in Nairobi Tuesday morning. His son, Senator Gideon Moi, confirmed in a press briefing hours after his death. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta has issued a proclamation on Moi's death, declaring a period of national mourning to last until the funeral day. Kenyans remember the president in different ways. Rahel Ombor reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Kenya's second and longest-serving president, Daniel Toroitich Arap Moi, died Tuesday morning. Kenya's presidency and his family confirmed. No cause of death was given, but reports say Moi had experienced breathing problems in recent months. Gideon Moi, the former president's son, spoke at a news conference at the Nairobi hospital where Moi passed away while undergoing treatment.
I'd like to take this opportunity to tell my fellow Kenyans that Mzee passed on this morning at 5:20. He passed away peacefully. I was by his side. And as a family, we've accepted. And mine is just to give my heartfelt gratitude to all Kenyans and non-Kenyans for the prayers and thoughts that have been given to Mzee and to our family.
Moi took over Kenya's presidency following the death of the country's first president, Jomo Kenyatta, in 1978. Moi would then rule the country until 2002 when he retired. Moi was considered as a kind man by his supporters. 37-year-old Ken Mwema, for instance, remains nostalgic about the free milk program the president rolled out in the 90s across all public schools.
Every student was looking forward to going to school to get the free milk. Other than the milk, of course, there was a good education. Those are the very fond good memories I have of him. Yes, the country was more stable. There was more unity. Kenyans were more patriotic to Kenya. There was tribalism, but it was not as it is today. It's out there everywhere right now.
For critics, Moi was a dictator who ruled with an iron fist. Moi faced local and international criticism over human rights abuses, nepotism, and corruption. Opponents sometimes were arrested and taken to torture chambers. Survivors who later described the chambers as being dark, filled with cold water, and with nowhere to sit. Human rights activist Ruth Mumbi blames Moi for what he calls the problems we have today.
For me, I remember Moi as a dictator, a tyrant, who didn't want to be criticized. He was one person who always felt tribal animosity, which up to date still it has been a challenge to reconcile different communities, which was his one of his undoing.
Political analyst Herman Manyora says it was Moi's leadership that kept Kenya stable at a time when other African countries were falling apart.
He was present at a time when in Africa there was a lot of turmoil, and therefore sometimes when you are leading people in times such as those, you could be seen to be a man of excesses. All around us, apart from Tanzania, all these other countries, you know, they were in a mess. They were all run down by military coups and instabilities and so on and so forth. He was able to keep the country together those bad days, difficult days, for 24 years.
In a proclamation Tuesday, President Uhuru Kenyatta described Moi as a great African statesman, an African icon, and an ardent Pan-African, and a devoted Christian. Kenyatta declared a period of national mourning that will last until Moi's funeral. Rael Ombor, For VOA News, Nairobi.
Still in Kenya, Moi led Kenya for 24 years, the nation's longest-serving president, crushing dissent and arresting and torturing those who oppose his rule. But Moi is also accredited with a peaceful leadership transition after his party was voted out of power in 2020. Mohamed Yusuf looks at the life of former President Daniel Arap Moi.
Oduor Ongwen was a student leader at the University of Nairobi in the 1980s and often clashed with the government of the late President Daniel Arap Moi.
Again, in 1986, I was arrested. Again, on a charge of sedition, I was jailed for 4 years, which I had to serve at Kamiti Maximum Prison. So those are the kind of prices I and many of our colleagues, which were progressive student leaders, had to pay. For standing out to say that Kenyans deserve better.
When Ongwen and his fellow student protested against Moi government, agents removed educational materials from the school.
The university was never the same because the libraries had been raided, the bookshops had been raided. Any material that they considered unpalatable, using what they call state security, was removed from the libraries.
As Vice President, Moi came to power in 1978 after the death of Kenya's first president since independence from Britain, Jomo Kenyatta. Kenya became a de facto one-party state under the Kenya African National Union Party. Moi ruled from 1978 to 2002, Kenya's longest-serving president. Lydia Wamboi lived the Kenya's capital at the time. Wamboi says, "What I remember about him is that there were a lot of thuggeries, there were no roads and no development. There were a lot of street children and the city was very dirty. In other words, infrastructure was very bad, but on the positive, life was not that bad," she says. Moi's foes saw him as a dictator who enriched allies and cracked down on opponents. But Moi supporters like Jane Comen saw him as a strong leader who connected more directly with the people. She says Moi used to give school-going children milk, and he also helped build a lot of schools across the country. In 1990, President Moi gave in to internal and international pressure to allow multi-party elections, which he won in 1992 and 1997. Moi was constitutionally barred from running again in 2002, and his party's candidate Uhuru Kenyatta, the son of the first president, lost to Mwai Kibaki. Though Kenyatta would later be elected in 2013 and 2017, Moi quietly retired from politics. Kenya's political commentator Harma Munyora says Moi heeded to the pressure and allowed change to happen.
He was quick to read the changing times. He was quick to see that the wind was so strong he could not stop it. So he quickly allowed in change, and as the saying says, don't stop change. Bring it on and then manage it. I think he did that very, very, very effectively.
Overall, former President Moi leaves behind a mixed legacy as Kenya is still struggling to free itself from the corruption and abuses rooted in his era. But Moi can also be credited with bringing multi-party democracy to Kenya and creating the modern presidency. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Sudan, Egypt and Ethiopia have only agreed on 3 points of contention on construction of the controversial Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam project after 4 days of negotiations in Washington. The three countries agreed on a schedule that includes a plan for filling the dam in stages, a mechanism for dealing with droughts during the filling process and during the dam's operation. The U.S. drafted a document of agreement on those points that was unilaterally signed by Egypt. The three countries agreed to resume talks on February 12 to 13 on other issues, including how to resolve the disputes. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashenawi spoke to Joseph Sigley, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, about the significance of the initial agreement.
The three countries did issue a joint statement at the end, agreeing on a couple of the important technical issues, such as a plan for filling the dam in stages, talking about contingencies in case of droughts and water scarcity, and jointly thinking through how the process is going to happen. And this is building on, you know, previous technical reviews about filling the dam in different stages. And so I think it's actually it's a positive development that they seem to have agreed to some of these technical details. In principle, it seemed that all sides had agreed on some of these technical issues. And so I think it's a positive step forward.
The three countries agreed to resume the talks on February 12 and 13 on the mechanism of monitoring and following up the implementation of the agreement, the exchange of data and information, and on the mechanism of dispute settlement. What could the U.S. mediation offer to make a final agreement achievable and verifiable?
Well, in the end, the agreement is going to have to be something that all three sides accept and abide by. And so I think the role of the U.S. is really there as a guarantor, as a means of providing assurance to all sides that their interests, their considerations will be fairly weighed, gives the parties to the agreement a recourse if they feel that, you know, something is not being fulfilled to the specifications that had been agreed to. And so I think, you know, the U.S. can play a valuable role as an outside actor, doesn't have a direct vested interest, and that can just provide some assurances. Over time, I think the goal here on all sides is to build a long-term management mechanism for the dam, that you know, the negotiations aren't just about the current decisions on filling the dam, but it's on the long-term management. And if you can establish that basis of trust, if there's a strong technical foundation for the decisions, if all sides have been part of that, then I think it's going to lead to a lot smoother management of the dam once it's operational. I think that's what we should be looking for.
The three countries reached an initial deal in 2015 announcing the so-called Declaration of Principles, per which the dam should not cause any harm to the Nile downstream countries. What would such agreement entail in case Ethiopia imposed de facto conditions that may harm Egypt or Sudan?
Well, the statement of principles, which I think have provided a very strong basis for the negotiations all along and continue to do so, basically line up that the dam is not intended to cause significant damage to any of the parties, that there will be fair and appropriate use of the Nile resources. It talks about the importance of a trust-building process, both in terms of the negotiations for the filling of the dam, but also in the longer-term management. And I think finally, and most importantly, that there's a principle of peaceful settlement of disputes. There's a recognition that the different sides aren't going to agree on everything, but there's an agreement that these differences can be resolved amicably and ideally among the parties themselves. But if for whatever reason that shouldn't be satisfactory, any of the parties has the right to appeal to outside mediation to try to facilitate a positive outcome. And so in that sense, I don't think the scenario of Ethiopia unilaterally making a decision that would be damaging to the other two states is likely, because Ethiopia has already agreed that this needs to be done in a cooperative manner. And if there are issues that come up that are deemed to be of concern and violation to one of the other parties, they have a means of bringing in other actors. And indeed, that's partly why the U.S. has been called in into the process at this point.
That was VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi speaking with Joseph Sigley, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, young South Sudanese stage a demonstration over a meeting between Israel and the head of the Sovereign Council. Find out what happened when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
How would you describe a comfortable life?
It's just being free and well in a way you are. Just like if at all someone feels good with only eating lunch or eating local food, not like someone who might be eating chicken. So it depends on what you feel, what you have, what you can accommodate.
I think a comfortable life is that life where you're well off, like financially, you have everything that you need, and when we come to health, your health is good.
I find comfort in being able to meet all my financial needs. That's where I find comfort. If you're able to pay your water bill, you're comfortable. Then on the other side of health, if you're healthy, you don't have any disease, I feel you're comfortable.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our health segment, and today we are talking about global cancer rates. The World Health Organization reports cancer is on the increase around the world, but it says preventive measures can save the lives of millions of cancer sufferers over the next decade. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva at the launch of the report to coincide with World Cancer Day on February 4th.
Over the past decade, nearly every country in the world has seen an increase in the number of cancer patients. The World Health Organization reports 1 in 6 people will develop cancer in their lifetime, causing at least 10 million deaths from this disease every year. If current trends continue, WHO warns new cancer cases will rise by 60% by 2040, more than 80% in low- and middle-income countries. The technical officer in cancer control at WHO, Andre Ilbawi, says more people are dying from cancer in the poorer countries because they lack the services and cancer control measures that exist in the richer countries. He says controlling the disease does not have to be expensive.
Our report presents the first investment case from WHO for cancer services, that governments, by investing in cancer, can save 7 million lives by 2030. And that is at the cost of $2.70 per person in low-income countries and $8.15 per person in upper-middle-income countries. This is feasible.
WHO says cancer does not have to be a death sentence. Prevention works. The director of the International Agency for Research on Cancer, Elisabetta Vidopas, says there have been tremendous advances in research on cancer prevention and treatment, and these are successfully keeping many people alive who otherwise would have died.
Preventive policies such as the elimination of occupational exposures to carcinogens, tobacco control measures, vaccination against cancer-causing infectious agents, and screening for early stages of cancer are potentially powerful ways to reduce not only the average incidence and mortality for cancer, but also socioeconomic inequalities in cancer occurrence.
In its report, WHO highlights a wide range of measures proven to be effective in preventing new cancer cases. For example, it notes tobacco-related diseases account for 25% of cancer deaths. Quitting this deadly habit, it says, can save billions of dollars and millions of lives. WHO says a vaccine against hepatitis B can prevent liver cancer. It notes another vaccine against HPV, the most common sexually transmitted infection, can virtually eliminate cervical cancer. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
From Geneva, we move to Khartoum. The head of Sudan's ruling body, the Sovereign Council, met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Monday to discuss normalizing relations between the two countries. The meeting sparked criticism from religious leaders and some officials in Sudan. Dozens of youth protested this past hour in Khartoum, condemning the meeting, saying Sudan should not have bilateral relations with Israel. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
Young people demonstrated this afternoon outside the office of the Sudan's Council of Ministers in Khartoum, chanting slogans that describes General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan's decision to meet with Israelis Netanyahu as betrayal. The protesters say Israel has been an enemy to many Arab countries, including Sudan. They say Israel has worked for decades against Islam in the Middle East, and there is no path forward for bilateral relations with Israel. Sudanese protester Muhammad Ibrahim Fadul describes the meeting as illegitimate. Fadul argues al-Burhan does not have the power to open new relations with any country during the transitional period, including Israel. Speaking in Arabic, he notes Sudan has supported the Palestine people since Sudan's independence in 1956 and cannot change this position through a transitional government.
This kind of decision needs an elected government and needs an elected legislature that represents people, because this is an affair of sovereignty of Sudan. This decision is supposed to be taken to the parliament to take an action on it, because they represent the people of Sudan.
Speaking in Arabic, Sudanese protester Alaa Hassan also condemned al-Burhan Netanyahu's meeting, saying the Israeli people have killed scores of innocent civilians in Israeli-occupied territories and have taken their land by force.
We are all aware that this land doesn't belong to Israel, but they grabbed it from the indigenous people of Palestine. This is where our third ancient mosque is located in Jerusalem, and we as youth are against this move.
Another Sudanese protester, Wafa Abdul Wahab Yusuf, says Sudan should not take this risk of involving Israel at the moment when Sudan is just beginning a new era. Speaking in Arabic, Yusuf says engaging Israel now might lead to another civil war in Sudan, as it happened with South Sudan after declaring its independence.
We know a lot of countries that have built a bilateral relation with Israel, and they have not economically improved. Look at Eritrea and South Sudan. Israel has been one of the reasons why our brothers in South Sudan seceded. Now their government is killing civilians and they have never had any say.
Protester Izzadin Suleiman has a different view. Suleiman says building a relationship with Israel at this moment could improve Sudan's economy, and Israel could help remove Sudan from the U.S. list of countries sponsoring terrorism.
When we have a good relationship with Israel, for sure we may get out of the terrorists, and that's what we hope, because our economy is now just remaining with this thing to develop. We are suffering here a lot, and the country has been suffering for a long, long time.
Sudan's Minister of Information and Government spokesman Faisal Mohamed Saleh issued a statement yesterday saying the entire cabinet has not been informed about the meeting of General Abdel Fattah with Israeli Prime Minister. Members of the Sovereign Council and the Cabinet have been in a closed-door meeting for hours as they are being briefed by General Abdel Fattah on what was discussed with Netanyahu during his visit to Entebbe on Monday. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
An arrest warrant has been issued for former South African President Jacob Zuma after he failed to attend the first day of his corruption trial. It was supposed to start at the High Court this morning, but Zuma's lawyers brought a sick note indicating that their client would not be available because he was out of the country for medical treatment. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Judge Daya Pillay issued the warrant after an application by the prosecution, which expressed the frustration with Zuma's failure to avail himself for the trial. Pillay expressed great frustration with the sick note, including that it had no details of what Zuma was suffering from.
This is a document titled Medical Confidential, and in brackets is marked pharmacy copy, without any date attached to the stamp. It uses an abbreviation HCP, which has no explanation on the form. What this court requires is evidence, authentic, reliable proof.
There were alterations on the sick note, but the author did not sign for those. The judge also questioned the doctor's credentials after Zuma's lawyer failed to confirm his practice number. Earlier on, lead prosecutor Billy Downer told the court that Zuma had frustrated all their efforts to get more details on his illness.
So by the time he left the country, the invitation to Mr. Mancha on behalf of Mr. Zuma, the invitation from the state to please give us some idea of what is going on, what his condition is, and why he has to go out of the country, he received that invitation, and that invitation has been ignored.
But Zuma's lawyer, Daniel Mancha, insisted that the sick note was enough proof that Zuma was indeed ill.
Yes, there's a medical certificate submitted. Yes, there's every proof that President Zuma is out of the country receiving a medical treatment. Yes, there's an offer that the matter be adjourned so that the court can satisfy itself.
The warrant was suspended pending the court's investigations on Zuma's illness claim. Experts say if the court is not satisfied and rejects Zuma's claims, he could be arrested and remanded in custody until the commencement of his trial on the 6th of May. But if he proves to the court that he was indeed ill, the warrant will be cancelled. Zuma is facing charges of corruption, fraud, racketeering and money laundering. The charges are linked to the multi-million dollar arms deal which South Africa embarked on soon after independence. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
That story by Tuso Kumalo from Johannesburg brings us to the end of our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Nakei Nairobi by Mbeli Mbel. We've been listening to Mbeli Mbel with the song Nakei Nairobi. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.